Hello, Jenny Roper, editor of Work magazine here. Popping up very quickly before this episode of What If, just to let you know that if you're enjoying this podcast, chances are you'll love Sister Title Management Today's podcast too. The Leadership Lessons podcast delves into the world of leadership and management, bringing insights, trends and advice to the ears of busy senior leaders every week. Previous interviewees include FTSE 100 CEO André Lacroix, Harvard Business Review author Amy Gallo, and kidnap negotiator Scott Walker. Get it wherever you usually get your podcasts. Have you ever allowed your imagination to run wild about the world of work, to wonder what would happen if we tore up all the rules and started again? Welcome to What If, a podcast from the CIPD's Work magazine that dares to ask the previously unthinkable.
I'm Katie Jacobs, and this week I'm looking back into the recent past and examining lessons learned, or not, to ask, what if there was another pandemic? Unfortunately, according to many scientists and risk management experts, it's not so much a question of if as when. Witnesses giving evidence at the UK's ongoing COVID-19 inquiry have rated the chances of another novel pandemic hitting us from a realistic possibility to an inevitability. But forget for a moment about the next pandemic. Is it really fair to assume that COVID-19 is done and dusted? From return to the office edicts to large-scale events and the increasingly rare use of masks, the signs certainly suggest that for many people, life has returned to normal, apart from an increase in remote working. The behaviour of many of us could almost make it feel as though a pandemic had never happened. Yet, according to recent data, it was estimated that 2.3% of the population of England and Scotland, around 1.2 million people, had COVID. And this figure is likely to be much higher, given many people don't report their test results anymore. Despite the virus now being far less dangerous to the majority of the population, thanks in part to a successful vaccination programme, it is still very much circulating. The current COVID-19 inquiry is laying bare, in often excruciating detail, how unprepared the UK was for the pandemic, and how poorly the government handled it, in the first few months especially. No country can be perfectly prepared, but it can certainly be underprepared, said lead counsel to the inquiry Hugo Keith as the investigation kicked off last June. If another pandemic is an inevitability, would we be better prepared this time? Or are there still vital lessons that haven't really sunk in? But it's not just another pandemic we should be concerned about. The series of events we've lived through since 2020 have been so impactful, so, yes, unprecedented, that Collins Dictionary named its 2022 word of the year permacrisis. It's a term that perfectly encapsulates that dizzying, exhausting feeling of lurching wildly from one crisis to the next, from Russia invading Ukraine to increasingly common and destructive climate-related events, the Israel-Gaza conflict and resulting shockwaves in the Middle East, to three prime ministers in less than 2 months in the UK. For leaders trying to plan ahead while managing the impacts of crisis after crisis, it's been a rough ride. So looking forwards, is it really a case that we can only try to expect the unexpected? Or could the lessons of the last 4 years teach us how to mitigate incoming risks, whatever angle they come from, if only we'd learned to pay close enough attention? What have, or more pertinently perhaps should, we have learnt from the experience of living through COVID-19? What could the next pandemic look like? And how can we be prepared for it? And whatever else is coming our way. To address these serious and scary questions, I spoke to two experts who have paid close attention to how governments, institutions and leaders have coped over the last 4 years. David Alexander is Professor of Emergency Planning and Management at University College London and was an expert witness at the UK's COVID-19 inquiry. And Cassandra Berry is Professor of Immunology at Western Australia's Murdoch University. We started the conversation by reflecting on how prepared, or otherwise, governments were for the pandemic, casting our minds back to early 2020. Here's David first on the UK response.
The UK should have been very prepared because it has a risk register and pandemics were the top of the list, the most likely kind of major emergency with the most substantial consequences. Therefore, the UK should have been very prepared. However, I think we can say that attention drifted away from pandemics towards counter-terrorism and Brexit planning. That was problematic for the pandemic situation. The UK sold off many of its stocks of usable equipment, including masks and respirators and things. Eventually was an abyss between the planning and the ability to realise the plan in emergency action. Therefore, we were not prepared in this country. We most definitely had the knowledge. What we didn't have was an adequate preparedness and the ability to turn the plan into action. In my view, errors in government have led to the loss of 50,000 lives that perhaps could have been saved and the complete waste of about £50 billion.
And here's Cassandra on whether the Australian government did any better.
We definitely weren't prepared. From my point of view, in Australia, we thought the events in China were so far away and were thoroughly contained. So it really did take us by surprise. We were really waiting for government authorities to respond and navigate between states of emergency and quarantine acts to keep us safe. But for a lot of us, some decisions were taking far too long in hindsight. We didn't know enough about the novel coronavirus, so we were actually watching a pandemic unravel in real time. We have to remember that we didn't know how to stop its explosive spread across the world, even though we had seen related viruses like SARS and MERS previously. But coronavirus was a complete surprise because we were predicting an influenza virus as the next pandemic. And there were many gaps in our preparedness plans. So we didn't know enough about the virus transmission patterns, so how it spread from human to human, its virulence characteristics, that's how dangerous or pathogenic the virus could be, and then prophylactic measures to prevent infection. We didn't have screening tests for diagnostics. We didn't have antivirals that were approved. And vaccines actually took about 6 months to develop.
So the answer to how prepared were we is a definite not very. In the 4 years since, what, if anything, does David feel we've learnt about managing pandemics and disasters in general?
That is something I think we're going to find out. I know what they could have learnt, I know what they should have learnt, but whether they have learnt it is another question, and whether that learning is retained. One problem that the government has had is that it tends to cycle people through particular jobs in the emergency sectors, and when they go on to something else, the expertise that they have accrued is lost. I don't know whether businesses are like that, but I suspect they are as well. Therefore, there is a strong risk that those who do have the expertise will be out of the loop by the time the next one comes along. What we cannot do is be complacent about it. We need to retain the learning, the organisational learning, the learning of the businesses, not merely the people in them, about what to do and how to survive and to manage this. Businesses really, whether they are large or small, need a risk register. They need some idea about how to maintain continuity of activity, how to manage emergencies when they come along, how to have foresight about what might happen to them in the future, and how to recover when it does happen. Any business of any particular size perhaps ought to have that squared away so that if something does happen, then there is a degree of readiness.
Given rates of COVID-19 remain high globally, yet much of our day-to-day behaviour has returned to normal, perhaps even on an individual level, we haven't really learned much at all. Here's Cassandra on the current risk level.
After 4 years of this pandemic, most organisations have largely returned back to normal business practices, particularly when the government restrictions were relaxed. However, if you look at the world stats right now, COVID cases have mounted to nearly 700 million across the world, and about 7 million people have died of COVID. What would the statistics look like if the fatality rate was higher, like Ebola virus? Then we're talking about 500 million deaths. I think as an organisation level, we still have a lot to learn, in particular people, employees that may have comorbidities or other infections. If we have a pandemic virus, the two infections can make each other worse.
While rates remain so high, organisations and individuals risk slipping into dangerous complacency, she warns. Presenteeism is simply not healthy and could even cost lives.
If you are sick, you should stay away from work. It still should be a self-quarantine period if you're responsible for at least 7 days. some people can still be infectious 14 to 21 days. And in fact, there are about 7 different Omicron sublineages circulating right now, which all of them are highly contagious. And you also have to think about long COVID. So even though you may not feel really, really sick, a mild dose of this COVID can also lead to those persistent long COVID symptoms, which we're still trying to explore in research and try and abate. I think if you're sick and you know you are positive with coronavirus, you should really change your work habits. So if you still feel well enough to work, I think it should be more digital or online, work from home. And I think organisations should have updated policies where that integrated style or hybrid work pattern can continue. If you look at the infrastructure of buildings or workplaces, a lot of them are towers in cities, it's high density, you've got to catch a lift to your floor. There are communal open office plans. These are all great infrastructure for breeding viruses. If you are well enough to come in, you should still wear a mask for a while if you're post-COVID, and perhaps be moved to a screened area where you're not kept in close contact to healthy people. Viruses really can't do anything unless they invade your cells. And initially, it's about keeping the sick away from the healthy.
And that lack of concern is particularly worrying given another pandemic is probably only a matter of time. Here's Cassandra again on where the next highly contagious infection could come from. Maybe skip this bit if you're of a squeamish disposition.
Another pandemic is just a matter of time, but it is quite unpredictable about what infectious agent it will be driven by. We're well overdue for another flu pandemic, if you look at the events through history, but it could come from a number of different infectious agents. And in fact, the biggest blip on our radar is zoonotic infections. So they are viruses that come from animals and jump the species barrier into humans. So there is a prediction that the next pandemic is likely to be another airborne RNA virus. These viruses mutate and evolve very quickly, that has jumped from monkeys or bats in Africa into humans. And just as an example, a monkey B virus doesn't cause any clinical symptoms in a monkey like macaques. But if we are exposed to it as humans, we can die within 3 weeks where your brainstem will liquefy really rapidly. So there's some really nasty viruses out there that we just don't want to get anywhere near to. Others also predict an arthropod-borne virus might be the next pandemic. So by that we mean a virus that can be transmitted by mosquito bites. So we really need to identify the epicenters really early to have those warning signs and to be monitoring them before the virus escapes into super cities, mega cities, where there are millions of humans as new hosts or food for the virus to replicate and spread. Climate change is another driver, whether it's natural or human behaviour driven. Cutting down rainforests is creating a shift in the habitat of some of these animals, and particularly vectors like mosquitoes. So they're encroaching more with humans. That's where humans and these viruses have a shattered coexistence of peace, where viruses were in their normal hosts, but in jumping across barriers into humans, they are causing more problems as they adapt to mammalian hosts.
But another pandemic isn't the only risk we face. Here's David on some of the other areas leaders, and perhaps HR, should have on their risk radars.
I think we're now in a sort of recovery process, except that we are moving into other uncharted waters or choppy waters with other sorts of risk and hazard. For example, what about proliferating technological failure? Supposing you are dependent on the internet and you have the kinds of problems where your internet dependency no longer works. I think we have to look carefully at those and at the state of the world. What we need is foresight. You need to sit down and think, well, what could happen in the future? What are the weak signals? In other words, signs that this might be brewing up.
Like Cassandra, David raises the impact of climate change as altering the profile of potential disasters. Let's hear more from him on how our changing climate and related extreme weather events could impact businesses, and what leaders should do to prepare.
We are into an age where we're going to get more substantial, prolonged cold snaps, heat waves, storms, floods, meteorological events that are more frequent and more concentrated? Are you dependent on water if we have a drought? And if so, what's likely to happen? Is your business floodable? If so, is there anything you can do about that? Can you flood-proof your business? Can you at least have warning? Can you try and protect your stock and things like that? I'm always dismayed to see places that have been flooded where there are movable goods. Japan, in a recent typhoon flooding, had something like 12 Shinkansen, which are high-speed bullet trains, of the latest generation underwater. Now, a train is a movable good. If they got them out of the way, they could have saved $126 million because they had to scrap all of them. I think that we're into the age of intersecting crises, which means we might have natural hazards and we might have conflict and we might have technological failures fitting together. For example, during COVID, there were three major earthquakes in Croatia, Greece and Turkey and Japan. They required a very different approach to managing the pandemic, the opposite of social distancing, so-called. I think we have to look at this as best we can and ask yourself, to what extent am I dependent on things beyond my control, and how can I wrest back a little bit of control by having redundancy, if not in equipment and supplies, at least in the way of thinking about how to manage the business?
And here's Cassandra again on another terrifying health-related risk, in case you weren't terrified enough by this point, that we should all be more aware of.
The elephant in the room is the threat of bioterrorism using an infectious agent such as a virus. And if you look at smallpox, it killed 500 million people in the 20th century. And through vaccination campaigns, we were able to successfully eradicate that virus. But most populations today have little or no immunity to it, so we're highly susceptible. So I think we need to also have defence mechanisms in place against the threat of things like that.
So, now that we are all suitably freaked out about the potential disasters on the horizon, what can business leaders actually do to prepare their organisations and their people? What does good risk management look like when we face unprecedented disruption coming at us from every angle? Here's David.
First thing they can do is stop talking about black swans. There are no black swans in this field. The black swan is extinct and its ecological niche has been colonised by the red herring. This is a situation in which there is nothing that hasn't happened before in some form. For example, if you take 9/11 in New York City, it wasn't the first time that a jet aircraft had crashed into a skyscraper in Manhattan. So, OK, we need foresight, which is to say we need to say, well, what could it be like in the future? You can use a technique called counterfactual analysis. It's not terribly complex. It's not rocket science. It simply means, OK, we've had events or we've not had events, but we might have done. What if it had been better? What if it had been worse? That's upward and downward counterfactual analysis. And you can ask yourself, what's the scenario? You need to think quite formally about what the scenarios are for failure or for apparently insurmountable problems. Therefore, what will we do about it? What resources would we need? How would we manage the situation? A little bit of foresight. What do we face in the future? As a country, we face unplanned mass migration. We face natural hazards, which are more frequent and considerably higher magnitude as a result of climate change. We face space weather, which is coronal mass ejections of the sun that can interfere with space-based navigation, in other words, satellite navigation and satellite communications, and could conceivably knock out electricity for weeks on end. We all depend totally on electricity nowadays. What would we do if there were none for a considerable period? Is there anything we can do? Now, there are some things you can't do anything about, but there are others where you can build up the expertise and possibly also some resources to be able to ride out the storm. Might even be an actual storm that you're riding out, otherwise metaphorical storm.
Risk management can slip into the realm of tick box governance, but David is clear it needs to be treated far more meaningfully than that, as he explains.
All we know about business continuity management tells us that top management have got to be involved in the process. That doesn't mean they have to spend a huge amount of time. I do sympathise with them for all the things that they have to come up against, but this really has not to be treated as just another layer of bureaucracy. This is a serious problem that can easily wipe out businesses. It can take away their stock, connections with customers, their ability to manufacture, their supply lines. It is definitely worth investing time and money in this because it could save the business from going belly up at the appropriate moment, and that might hit at any point in time.
And in terms of preparing for the next pandemic, we as a society need to make sure we have the skills required to tackle it as swiftly and effectively as possible. But with STEM skills on the decline, this isn't a given. Here's Cassandra on the need to build a scientific skills infrastructure that's fit for purpose.
I think we really need to, first of all, maintain education providers, our schools and our universities. They are the facilities that will help build the knowledge for future generations. And most of us realise that viruses can mutate very quickly. Some can evolve, though, by recombining their genetic information, and some can, like flu, can reshuffle different gene fragments. And on top of that, some viruses integrate into our DNA. So we really need a lot more scientists that can understand that genetic side of viruses, because once we know this gene sequence, we can then develop vaccines and antiviral targets for the virus replication. In terms of people coming through, I think there's a real gap in females, particularly in STEM. At the lower levels in primary school and junior high school, there's probably equal girls and boys interested in the topic, but girls seem to drop out and not pursue the higher levels of study. And I know they need to navigate child rearing and perhaps return back to the workforce, but they bring a lot of unique leadership skills. So in Australia, it's been predicted that we've got about 75% of the future jobs being STEM-based. And we just don't have enough boys to fill those places, so we need the women to step up.
And, she adds, there are things business leaders should be considering too, from how conducive their workspaces are to infectious diseases running rampant, to how capable they are at meaningfully engaging with scientific evidence.
They need to adapt to modify policies in the workplace. If the threat is an airborne agent, then we really need to have to change the way we work, as in COVID. So hygiene practices, you know, that strategic communication of having hand sanitizer available, even masks available, reminding people about coughing and spitting and sneezing. If they're sick, stay home. And perhaps we should go further and have HEPA filters in our air conditioners. We need to have places where they can be well ventilated. So it's all about the air quality. Originally with COVID, we thought it was droplet transmission and we could just stand, you know, 1 metre away from each other and we'd be safe. But the rules kept changing and, of course, it was known to be airborne. And so even talking to somebody and inhaling and exhaling air can transmit the virus from person to person. So businesses in tower blocks, in crowded cities, with people commuting, public transport, that high density really needs to have risk mitigation performed. As leaders of organisations, there's a lot of reading material out there. I mean, the internet is huge with information. Some of it is misinformation. So I think you've always got to make sure you are reading something that is evidence-based. I would go to reputable sites like the CDC and the World Health Organisation.
Time to get educated then. But to return to our central question this episode, what if there was another pandemic? What impact would it have? Let's hear from Cassandra first.
It would definitely have a huge impact. Last month, there's an upsurge of respiratory-like illnesses and pneumonia in children in China. So the WHO are watching that very closely. Is it COVID? Is it perhaps some other infectious agent? A new pandemic could really devastate the ageing population and maybe leave orphans that would then need to step up to be our new generation. Don't underestimate the power of viruses as an infectious disease. I think to lessen the impact of a pandemic, we really need to recognise the existence that these agents are out there, find them, prepare ways to stop them, and hopefully if we find them early enough, we can stop them finding all of us.
And here's David.
It's hard to say for the simple reason that pandemics are not uniform. How easy is it for the pandemic to proliferate among people who have a chance of getting it? And then will it kill you if you get it? That is something that has to pan out during the event itself. It's quite possible that the next influenza or other viral pandemic will not be too bad. It's possible that it won't specifically, particularly affect Europe, but it is also possible that it might be something that spreads like wildfire with no defences against it except staying indoors, which many people cannot afford to do. We've got the knowledge, we've got the expertise. It's a question of using it.
Wise words. Let's just hope those with power and influence are listening.
You have been listening to the What If podcast, brought to you by the CIPD's Work magazine. To find out more about how the CIPD is dedicated to better work and working lives, visit cipd.co.uk. And don't forget to check out the rest of the What If series from your podcast provider or the peoplemanagement.co.uk website.